Okay, we're going to the scroll Nephi. We're going to Zechariah chapter 5. You got Zechariah in your Bible. Zechariah chapter 5. Okay, so anyway, here we're going to go. We're going to go to Vision 6, Vision 7. Vision 6 is a flying scroll. Vision 7 is the traveling ephah, and we're going to do chapter 5. And both visions, you have to keep this in mind. Remember, the context of Zechariah is talking about Israel, yeah, and focusing especially on Jerusalem. So it's the both visions are describing in some aspect the future kingdom of Israel, where Messiah will reign. So let's go to the flying scroll. Let's look at that, 5, 1 through 4. We're going to read that first, okay? Zechariah 5, verse 1. Then I lifted up my eyes again and looked, and behold, there was a flying scroll. And he said to me, "What do you see?" And I said, "I see a flying scroll, and it's 20 cubits long and 10 cubits wide." And if you want to calculate that into feet, it would be 30 feet by 15 feet. And you may have a Bible that has it that way. Then he said to me, "This is the curse that is going forth over the face of the whole land. Surely, everyone who steals will be purged away according to the writing on one side, and everyone who swears will be purged away according to the writing on the other side. I will make it go forth, and it will enter the house of the thief, and it will enter the house of the one who swears falsely by my name, and it will spend the night within that house and consume it with its timbers and stones." Now that's the idea of a curse. Not only the curse on the person, but the curse on his entire house. And you see that at various times in the Old Testament when people would sin against God in such a way that he would open the earth and swallow them up, like Korah and his rebellion in the book of Numbers. But that's the idea here. And what is it that brings the curse on the person? It's the way they behaved. They've either used the Lord's name either to lie against someone else, to bear false witness, or they've stolen from someone. Both of these things that are listed here are commandments, right? You recognize them? Thou shalt not use my name in vain, swear falsely, use my name in a false way. That's commandment number 3. And then you shall not steal. That's commandment number 1 of the 10. Really, all you need to know is there's 2 commandments out of the 10 that are listed here. So there's the flying scroll, he says it very clearly. He said it's 10 by 20 cubits. Now, why is that important? Because for the Jewish person who knew something about the law, 10 by 20 would have a meaning for them, because it would remind them of this place. That's the tabernacle in the wilderness. Out here is the altar where the animals are sacrificed. It's made out of brass. Here's the laver where the priests would wash between sacrifices. And back here is the holy place, and back behind that's the Holy of Holies. Now the place that's 10 cubits by 20 cubits is the holy place. When anyone in the nation of Israel sinned, that defiled the nation. And specifically, it defiled the holy place. Anyway, that's the picture that God wanted to present. Now who is it that bears the sin? If someone commits a sin in the nation, who bears that sin? The high priest. Now remember we saw who, what's the high priest's name? Joshua, yeah? The high priest bears the sins of the nation. And the high priest, when he puts on his garments, I showed you the garment, he has the ephod, the chest piece with the 12 stones on it, one for each tribe. So whenever anyone in the nation would sin, the high priest is bearing that sin. And how is the nation cleansed of that sin? Or all the multitudes and multitudes of sins that people would commit, or in the case of even a single person, the multitudes of sins a single person would commit within a year's time. How would that be cleansed away? Well, that would be cleansed away on the Day of Atonement, when the high priest goes in on that specific day and cleanses the holy place, this outer room within this tabernacle area. He would cleanse the items in this holy place. And this room is 10 cubits by 20 cubits, or 15 feet by 30 feet. And the whole distance here of both rooms is 45 feet. But this area, these things had to be cleansed once a year on the Day of Atonement. And that's the only day it was done. And the high priest would also open this curtain after burning incense on this altar and sprinkle blood on the Ark of the Covenant. But there's 3 things in this room. The holy place contains bread, that's on this table over here. It contains a menorah, or a candlestick, that has how many lights on it? 7. We saw the menorah already in one of the visions. And this is the altar of incense. And this is directly in front of this veil. And so the high priest would burn incense here, create a smoky kind of a cloud by which would give some covering for this Ark of the Covenant. as he opened the veil. All these things are gold. All these pillars are gold. There is no gold outside here. The altar outside and the laver outside are bronze, not gold. There's only gold inside. It costs a lot of money to do this. You know where they got the gold to do this? From Egypt. Yeah. The Egyptians, when they left on the Exodus, they said, here, take everything, just go. So all this gold they got from the Egyptians. Now the covenant that we read about in terms of the law, the Ten Commandments, that's the covenant between God and Israel through Moses. The covenant tablets are in this box called the Ark. Ark's just a box. It's also gold. Inside that box, there's two tablets, the tablets of the law. And the two laws that we referenced in the flying scroll are the third, thou shalt not use the name of the Lord thy God in vain in order to bear false witness, and that's the idea that's presented, and the eighth, thou shalt not steal. These two laws represent all of the law. And he's saying that anyone who's violating the law will be purged from the land. Let's go back and look at that. Verse 3. The law is called a curse. Why is the law called a curse? Why is the law really a curse for all of us?
Because now we have an awareness.
Awareness of what sin is and how do you deal with your sin? There's no way for us to get rid of it. The high priest going in and atoning for sin once a year with a what? What kind of sacrifice? A blood sacrifice. An animal has to die in the place of the sinner. And then the holy place is cleansed of sin from all the sins that have been committed previously in the previous year. Now the book of Hebrews says that when Jesus came and died as our high priest, he carried out a sacrifice that was what? Once for all. One sacrifice for all time. Therefore, there's no longer a need for animal sacrifice in order to atone for sin, because he accomplished a perfect sacrifice, and by entering into a faith relationship with him, we have complete and total covering for all sin for all time. And that's why what he has done is called the atonement, the substitutionary atonement in our behalf. But in Israel, before Jesus came, in order to picture what that once and for all sacrifice would be like, God said, do it once a year to cover the sins of the nation for a year. And that protected the nation of Israel from the wrath of God. Now, not everyone who lived in the nation of Israel was a believer, was one who believed in God and believed in his promises and was living as a righteous person. Not everyone was. But the atonement covered even all of their sins. It covered all the sins for all the nation. And that's the same way for Jesus Christ. It says he came into the world to what? To die for the sins of the world, right? Does everybody in the world believe in Jesus Christ? No. So is that atonement apply to them personally? No. Could it if they believed in him? Yes. That's the curse of the law. It shows us the nature of our sin, and it's to drive us to God to ask him for mercy. To say, Lord, I'm a sinner. Can I be redeemed? Can I be cleansed? Can I be made righteous? God's answer is yes, by simple faith in me. Now, he's talking here about what he's going to do before he establishes his kingdom. He is going to purge the land of all unrighteous men who are acting in sinful ways, who are outwardly sinful. He is going to purge the land of these people before his kingdom begins. That's why this is prophetic. That's why this is looking forward to a future kingdom. Now, we already saw when Joshua is cleansed as high priest, because he's what? He's filthy because he's bearing the sins of the nation, and he is cleansed. Back in chapter 3, what did he say? In 3:9, when he says to Joshua, I will remove the iniquity of that land in one day. He's looking forward to a finality when he will remove the iniquity of the land in one day. This vision here is a picture of that idea, of that final day when the Lord comes to establish his kingdom. He's going to remove all unrighteous from the land. And then what's that mean? The kingdom is going to start with only what? Righteous people. With people who are saved, with believers. That's how it's going to start. That's not going to stay that way, but that's how it's going to start. And we studied that in the book of Revelation. And he says, notice, that he said, not only is this law bringing a curse on these people to expose who they are, but I'm going to purge them away. The idea of being removed, completely removed, and separated from this nation. It's a very short little section, but it's a prophetic view of how he's going to accomplish this purging of the land and the means by which he's going to do it. The law stands in judgment against those who rebel and sin against God. The Lord's promise is, I will seek out the guilty, that's the lawbreakers, I will bring judgment on them, and I will destroy them. That's a summary of this, of those four verses. And this is the future removal of individual sinners from the land before the reign of Messiah begins. He brings judgment first, and then he brings his reign. Traveling ephah. How many of you know what an ephah is? Bushel basket. It's a unit of measurement. They measured grain in an ephah. We measure grain in a bushel. Let's read that, 5:5-11. Then the angel who was speaking with me went out and said to me, lift now your eyes and see what this is going forth. And I said, what is that? And he said, this is the ephah going forth. And again he said, this is their appearance in all the land. And behold, a lead cover was lifted up. And this is a woman sitting inside the ephah. And then he said, this is wickedness. That's what he calls the woman. And he threw her down into the middle of the ephah. I suppose she's trying to climb out. And cast the lead weight on its opening. Then I lifted up my eyes and looked, and there were two women coming out with the wind in their wings, and they had wings like the wings of a stork. And they lifted up the ephah between the earth and the heavens, and I said to the angel who was speaking with me, where are they taking the ephah? Then he said to me, to build a temple for her in the land of Shinar. She will be set there on her own base or on her own pedestal, like in her own temple. Now, where's Shinar? Babylonia. Yeah. Shinar is another name for Babylon. Okay, so that should ring some bells for those of you that have been in Revelation. This woman is in an ephah. She's probably not real happy about it because she's going to be trapped. So the woman in the ephah is carried away by these two women who have stork-like wings. Now, why stork-like wings? Well, storks were generally in Israel considered to be birds of faithfulness, birds that were faithful in kingdom of birds. In our culture, a stork is an image of what? Babies being carried and delivered. You consider these two women who have wings like storks to be agents of the Lord. They're going to be faithful in carrying out their mission. And what's their mission? Carry the lady to Shinar. To carry the lady out of Israel to Shinar. To look at it another way, if they're agents of the devil, if they're agents of Satan, they're going to carry her out of Israel, take her to Shinar, and assist her in setting up and establishing her on her pedestal. No way to really know. The idea of the stork is one of faithfulness. Evidently, they're going to be faithful no matter who they're serving. They're going to do it faithfully. After the lead weight is put on, so this lady wickedness can't get out, and she's going to be carried away and taken to Babylon. Now, this is a picture of old Babylon, the Tower of Babel, where the religious, political system of Babylon began, Genesis chapter 11, where God confounded the speech of everyone as a judgment. From this city of Babylon became actually the growth of all religion as we know them today. When he says, where are they taking the ephah? In verse 10, he says, they're going to take her to build a temple for her in the land of Shinar. And when it is prepared, she will be set there on her own pedestal. What this depicts is idolatry. She's going to be set up in a temple, in a worship system. Now, the one thing that the Jews got cured of by the Babylonian captivity was idolatry. Here you have a picture of idolatry being removed from Israel and taken to Babylon, where it really came from. But what had happened in Israel before the Babylonian captivity was they were enamored and actually enthralled with the idols of the nations. And the King Solomon had brought in more than 1,000 false idols into the temple before he died. And that's the reason that the Lord came in with the army of Nebuchadnezzar, destroyed the temple and the city, and said, I'm taking you into captivity into Babylon for 7 years because of your idolatry, your disobedience, and your refusal to obey my commands. And he made it very clear when he gave them the Ten Commandments and the covenant he made with them at Sinai, said, if you will obey me, I will bless you in the land. If you won't obey, I'm going to kick you out of the land. Now, he never took the land away from them because it's still their land and still under the promise that he made to Abraham. But he says, if you're disobedient, I'm not going to let you live there. you're my people, but I'm gonna remove you from there. And when he brought them back, and now they're back after the Babylonian captivity, the one thing they're cured of is idolatry. And they remain so right up to the time of the Romans, when Jesus was in his own ministry. This is one of the things that the Jews always fought with the Romans about, was the Romans wanted to bring their Roman flags with their little eagles on them into the temple area, and the Jews would, you know, they'd revolt, say, we don't want any idols in the temple. We don't want any images in the temple. So they got cured. But did that cure the world of idolatry? And that did not cure the world of religions that were based upon idolatry. And what we have as we look in the book of Revelation is the woman, in chapter 17 of Revelation, the woman who is going to be the idolatrous center in Babylon in the future. So Revelation 17, recall, it's the woman who's riding the beast, who the world pays homage to. The kings of the earth, it says, commit immorality with her. And Babylon becomes the center of religion and commerce again in the future. And, of course, is going to be ultimately destroyed. The Babylon of history is gone, of course, but there's a new Babylon. It was Saddam Hussein who said, I'm Nebuchadnezzar II, and I'm going to rebuild Babylon. I'm going to rebuild the glory of Babylon. So he began a building project, and this is part of it. And, of course, we went in and took it over and are using it for military base. You see some tanks over here. What does this woman say in Revelation 18? She glorifies herself and lives sensuously. She says in her heart, I sit as a queen. I'm not a widow. I will never see mourning. And yet, in the future, the Lord is going to take this whole system and destroy it before the kingdom begins. And that's where this is a picture, again, of the future of what the Lord is going to do before he establishes his kingdom. He's going to allow this woman, who he calls wickedness, this idolatrous system, to exist before he actually comes, removes it, not only removes the sin from his land, but will remove the sin of idolatry from the world and establish his kingdom. Now, this is just a sketch of this in Zechariah in this chapter. He's going to give a lot more detail as we move into later chapters. This seventh vision is a picture of the removal of all idolatrous wickedness from the land. Therefore, the kingdom will be a holy land. We'll jump forward a little bit, go back a little bit, Zechariah 2:12. The quote there in Zechariah 2, in one of the first visions, said, the Lord will possess Judah as his portion in the holy land. He's going to make the land holy and will again choose Jerusalem. 13, he says, be silent, all flesh, before the Lord, for he is aroused for judgment from his holy habitation. So he will come for judgment before he establishes Jerusalem. But once he establishes Jerusalem, he will call it the Holy Land. And it will be holy. Now, they call the land of Palestine today the Holy Land, but it's not. It's as corrupt as any other land in the world. But it won't always be that way. Another, just a summary statement, for both the scroll and the ephah, they both depict preparation for the kingdom, where the land is cleansed from sin, wicked individuals are removed, and wicked idolatry is removed. And really, at that point then, in time, when Jesus is ruling on the throne in Jerusalem, you will have no other God ahead of me or before me or besides me. But he will be the acknowledged King of Kings and Lord of Lords when he returns. Next week, another vision, four chariots. And this is the last one. And then we're going to come the following week and do a summary of all eight. And you're going to even do some work. I'm going to have you go back through all eight visions and do a summary of all eight visions. We're going to come together and talk about them, because they all form a composite.